Sacramento joined communities across the country grieving over the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. A service last night gathered hundreds of people at Congregation B'nai Israel. On Insight, Mayor Daryl Steinberg spoke at that event last night. He'll join me in the studio to talk about Sacramento's response. We'll also discuss the Stephon Clark investigation. And the president of Electrify America will join us to describe the new zero-emission vehicles that will be arriving in the Capitol later this week. Cap Radio's Nick Miller will expand on those same topics with more on each of them in our second half hour. A new documentary, which is stunning, by the way. It's from University of the Pacific, about to air on PBS stations. It explores the legacy of San Francisco's People's Mayor, George Moscone. And then California stage with the Sacramento premiere of Times Like These. I'm Beth Ruryak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruryak. A special Shabbat will be observed by many in the Sacramento region going into this weekend. That's in remembrance of the victims in Pittsburgh's synagogue shooting. It was standing room only last night with hundreds of people gathered at Congregation B'nai Israel. Our program today begins with one of the speakers, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. His family is part of that congregation. His wife, Julie, has been cantor for many, many years. And Mayor Steinberg, glad to have you here
today. Good to be with you, Beth.
Will you tell me about the connection to Pittsburgh that this region, this city, is experiencing?
Well, the horrific tragedy in Pittsburgh affected not only the Jewish community, but the larger community here in Sacramento in a very deep way. As I said last night, you know, thoughts and prayers for innocent victims from Pittsburgh are absolutely appropriate, but not nearly sufficient. I think it's time to call it out for what it is. There's a sickness in our country, and it's a sickness in our culture. Its origins are as old as the day. But in this particular political era, it creeps its ugliness above ground far too often without enough continued shock or revulsion. And you know, I said words matter. It's not a partisan act to call it for what it is, to admit that people bent on violence often act when they are told again and again that political opponents are enemies, that immigrants are criminals, and that those who espouse white supremacy are still good people. And you know, when I said those words last night, people responded in a very positive way, because it's no longer enough just to express our sympathies. We've got to translate the frustration and the fear into continued action, whether it's politics, whether it's community service, whether it's standing up and for people. And by the way, that's what Sacramento always does. You know, in 99, we were the victims of these horrible hate crimes. You look at the 20-year history, every time, whether it's the African-American community, the Latino community, the API community, the LGBT community, Muslim Americans, we have always stood with each other, and I cannot be prouder of a community that, to me, represents the best of American values. And we just need to take the pain and translate it into something that is real and that actually improves the lives of people and changes this sick culture, because enough is beyond enough.
In light of what you're saying, I'm sure you've seen that President Trump is heading to Pittsburgh today. And funerals, memorials are beginning there. What's your reaction to that? What about the timing?
I wish that the president would stay away and would pick another time. I think the mayor of Pittsburgh put it very well. The focus needs to be on the people who died and their families and a grieving community. And he's the president of the United States. I understand that. We all respect that. But I think he would do better by the people of Pittsburgh if he waited for another time. Look, you cannot on one hand say that you grieve with the people of Pittsburgh and do all the, quote, right things, and then say the kinds of things that he says constantly that seeks to divide and demean people. And again, it's so beyond partisanship now in this country. It's not about the fact that he's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. You know, it's about basic standards of decency and civility and about how we talk to each other, and especially people in high leadership positions. None of us are perfect, but we have an absolute responsibility to model the right kind of behavior, and I wish he would stay away from Pittsburgh.
So I want to get through a couple questions here because we have a lot to talk about related to this. I read a headline that said, focusing on the president in this diminishes the emphasis that should be on anti-Semitism. And I want your take on that. Sacramento has not necessarily a unique experience and yet a unique experience in what happened here in 1999 and since. And I do want to talk about the emphasis for you, whether it's more in the arena of anti-Semitism and hate or political and the rhetoric of the time.
Well, to me, much of it is related. Of course, anti-Semitism is thousands of years old, and it's not new. And but every time, we can never relax. We can never say, oh, we have actually overcome. Anti-Semitism, just like racism or prejudice in all forms, exists sometimes just below the surface. And unless we are constantly vigilant, it will creep its ugly head above the surface. And, you know, you look at the reports from the Anti-Defamation League, anti-Semitism had its biggest increase in 2017 in many, many years. And that should be a warning to all of us. And it's not all about political rhetoric, but words do matter. Think about, you know, Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gettysburg Address. Those were incredible words, but they only ultimately mattered because they were translated into powerful action to end the scourge of slavery. Words can heal. Words can change for the better. But words can also lead to destruction. And if we don't recognize the connection between what we say and how we say it and how we describe other people, Jewish people know the dangers of not speaking up and speaking out more than any other people, because you always want to think, oh, it couldn't happen here. Oh, that was the past. Oh, those are just words. Words matter, because words too often lead to action, and they can either lead to healing or they can lead to destruction. And that's the lesson here. And let's remember it, and let's change what must be changed.
At the end of the hour, by the way, we're going to talk about a play at Cal Stage, Times Like These. It's a Holocaust remembrance play. So we'll get to that later. The Unity Center at the California Museum, you were among the founders. The idea for it was born out of the 1999 bombing. So the doors are opening to everyone this weekend.
They are. First of all, we hope people go to the Unity Center if you haven't been there all the time, because it's worth going again and again. But yeah, the doors will be open and it's free this weekend. And I think that's really important. The Unity Center is intended to be the center of not only learning about California's struggles with discrimination and prejudice and what people, not just famous people, but ordinary people have done to overcome. But it's also a community gathering place where we can talk about the issues that still divide us. You know, again, I just want to say, Beth, how proud I am of Sacramento. While we're not perfect and we have many, many challenges, we always step up on behalf of each other. You know, at the temple on Sunday morning, there were leaders from the Latino American community, at the Muslim American community, in crossing guard vests, providing security for our temple. I cannot tell you how heartwarming that was for me as a Jewish American, but it goes the other way as well. Anytime somebody is victimized in this community, we stand together and we can't stop.
You're listening to Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, a shift of gears here. And that is to the investigation of the Stephon Clark shooting. It happened March 18th On October 25th, it moved from the city to the Sacramento County DA's office. What's your expectation of a timeline?
Well, I don't know how long it will take the district attorney, but I know that there is something different and unique about this investigation, and that is it's not only the district attorney who will be reviewing the police department's investigation.
Right,
it will also be
level.
The attorney general.
Correct.
And so that is very appropriate and is another check to make sure that whatever the conclusions are, that they are thorough and that they are fair. And I know people are impatient, as am I. I think thoroughness and transparency is more important than doing it quickly. So I don't know the time frame, but I do know that this will have an extraordinary amount of review, and that's appropriate.
Are you expecting 90 days?
I've heard the 90-day number before, but I just don't know whether or not this will be done within 90 days or not. I know it's out of the city's hands now and in the hands of other authorities, and we just want it to be fair and thorough.
I am going to introduce another guest who's been joining us quietly in the studio
Please.
During this conversation. He is Richard Steinberg, no relation to the mayor, though they do have the same last name. He is the president of Electrify America, a fairly new company that is about to have a very important role in Sacramento. Mr. Steinberg, glad to have you joining
Thanks
us
for having
today.
Me, Beth.
Are you here from Reston, Virginia?
I am.
So you're in Sacramento this week because of something that's happening in a couple days, and this has to do with the zero emissions effort, the rollout of electric cars. Do you want to explain, first of all, what November 1st means in this city?
Yes, we're very excited to be here this week. We're announcing our first of many investments in the city of Sacramento, part of a $44 million program called Green Cities. We've actually renamed it a little bit, called it Sac to Zero, because it includes many, many elements that are going to improve access to electric mobility for all the citizens of the city. So starting this week, we'll be launching our first service. It's called Envoy. Envoy is a residence-based or apartment-based service where you can rent, if you live in that facility, you can rent an electric vehicle, do your errands, you can rent it literally by the minute, and go about and return that vehicle to your property. It's a fantastic amenity for people that live in those buildings. But it's only the first of many investments we're making in the city. We're also investing in an entirely distinct and complementary car sharing service called Gig. And Gig is a free float car sharing model, which is really another very interesting concept, where you can pick up the car anywhere in a 13 square mile home zone and park it at any legal parking spot at your destination, including metered spots. So you can pick it up in Midtown and take it out close to Sac State, leave it for the next customer to pick up. It's really a fantastic program that we'll be launching in Q1 of next year. But that's not all. We're also investing, and I know the mayor is very excited about this, in a electric vehicle bus service between the city of Sacramento and UC Davis campus, which is a very exciting new offer. It's going to improve the frequency as well as, of course, making it electric. And we're also investing in the Franklin Boulevard program, which actually was recently announced, using gas-powered vehicles or diesel-powered vehicles. We're going to convert those vehicles over. It's an on-demand shuttle service. We're going to convert those vehicles over to electric shuttle buses.
So these waves get broader and broader as the program is rolled out. But as far as this week goes, Mayor Steinberg, will you talk about the location of the initial 20 vehicles and who you're aiming at?
Well, first of all, I think the number of vehicles, we're talking about 142 in the first round.
There'll be 71 properties, two vehicles at each property, and the first 20 locations have been identified, and those are the ones that are rolling out.
So how many vehicles this week?
We're announcing it at two separate properties this week, but within the next 30 days, there'll be 20 properties with two vehicles each.
Okay. That's right, but it's going to expand to 71
yeah,
properties
71
and 142, and mostly low-income apartment complexes. And so, you know, I talk a lot about inclusive economic growth in Sacramento and about growing a modern economy and connecting that growth to our neighborhoods, especially our low-income neighborhoods. And this Electrify America investment, we were chosen among all California cities to be the green city. And $44 million is a significant investment. And it is really a template and an example of this idea of growing the economy and connecting it to the neighborhoods. Because the first round here, we are providing electric vehicle mobility where people can rent relatively inexpensively these electric vehicles to run errands, to drop their children off at school, to get to work. And then next year, we're going to have 260 vehicles, kind of like the jump bikes in a way, that you can take within a 13-mile radius of the downtown and rent, again, pretty inexpensively to go to and from and leave the car at the destination. As I've been joking all week, it's like the jump bikes. We just don't want people to park the cars on the sidewalks,
right.
That's all. But other than that, this is Sacramento, again, being seen nationally.
Can I ask a couple basics?
Yes, please.
Do you need a credit card or a debit card to use one of the cars?
Absolutely. You do need
to. So that can be a hitch for people.
Yes, yeah. And we are actually working with a couple of the local agencies, AQMD, to figure out how to do the unbanked and how to provide a solution.
Can you give me an idea of the cost? We're saying a low cost.
Yeah, it's by the minute. And I think the Envoy service is, I think what he mentioned, he said 15 cents per minute,
15.
Or essentially $9 an hour. But again, if you're not using the full hour, it can be very affordable.
I have talked to folks who have gone out of the boundary with the jump bikes, and you get a letter in the mail saying there will be a penalty if you go outside of the boundary. So I assume there's the same sort of...
Well, the good news here is that you can take the car anywhere you wish. You can take it as far as you need to, and you can take it even up to Yosemite if you wanted to. The only difference between what this program offers and what something like the jump bike is that you can't end your reservation until you're back in the home zone or back at the initial property. Mm. So if as long as you're willing to keep paying for it, you won't be able to, you'll be able to take the car outside the zone, but you can't just leave it there and move on.
What will tell you whether this works here?
We have some great measurements that we're putting in place to make sure that we basically utilization is the primary method. We're going to look at people that enroll in the program and then measure how the cars are used. There's a certain target in terms of utilization over a 24-hour clock that we're looking for. And what's a little bit different, there are other car-sharing services that are out in California and elsewhere, but none of them really use electric mobility as the answer. So we're going to do things a little differently here because it's electric, and that's a little bit of fleet management challenges because the cars have to be charged. But we're also supporting that as part of our SAC to Zero initiative with over 10 different charging station depots, DC fast charging depots that allow you to charge the car very quickly. Those are available to anybody, not just the car sharing services. So if you own an electric vehicle personally, you'll have access to those charging stations, which is another part of the exciting investment.
Mayor Steinberg, you participated in a big article that was done by Curbed.
Yes.
And some of the gist of that article is that electric vehicles alone aren't going to solve California's emissions problem, and it'll reduce it to some degree in the capital city, but what's the main priority for jumping into a program like this?
Well, we have multiple priorities. One is to be a leader in the state and the nation in advancing these new technologies that are going to help solve the climate problem. And you're right, not one technology or one thing is going to do it, but cumulatively, all of these kinds of initiatives are going to make the difference. But I look at it in a even larger sense. For Sacramento, the capital city, we are trying to attract new industry and new high-wage, clean, green jobs. And this is a signal, a market signal again, that Sacramento is the place to do business. Look, we're
That thought, what one or two factors convinced you, Richard Steinberg, that Sacramento was the place to do business?
Sacramento was actually an ideal place to launch a service like this. We wanted a medium-sized city, and we wanted a city that basically had commuting patterns that would be conducive to something like car sharing. And Sacramento doesn't really bleed into any other metropolitan areas, and those commuting patterns are quite predictable. So we really were excited to select Sacramento. It wasn't because it was the capital. It was not the reason. It really offered a great chance to experiment with these different car sharing services.
Okay, two
I would
more
add,
basics,
you also
though.
Had a willing. You also had a willing city who wanted to take this on.
Absolutely.
The mayor has to get that.
I had to get that in. It's true.
All right. Do you need car insurance to use one of these cars?
No, that's another beauty. So all the insurance is covered, as well as the energy, the gas equivalent. So these are electric. But the fuel, as well as the insurance, is part of your minute
in the
rent.
Parking meters. Don't forget that.
In the gig car sharing, which is the one that's coming next quarter, that includes parking as well.
Okay, for the ones coming this week, when we see that reddish-orange bike, we know jump bike, we know what that means. What are these cars going to look like, and what do we call them?
So these are Envoy, and this particular case, they are Volkswagen e-Golfs. They're white with Electrify America and an Envoy graphics on the vehicles. Those will be very visible. And they're also, what's nice about the properties that we're installing them at, we're also installing a charging station that will support both of those vehicles. So you'll also see the visible investment in charging facilities at these locations with the cars.
Thank you both for bearing with me. We had to cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time, and I appreciate that you were both here. It was timely in a lot of ways.
Thank you, Beth, on all subjects. Yeah. And really excited for these new investments. It's going to continue to make Sacramento a very exciting place to live.
Well, in my studio again, Steinberg and Steinberg. That doesn't happen very often, but Richard Steinberg is the president of Electrify America. Thank you for joining us today. Mayor Daryl Steinberg, always a willing guest here, which we continue to appreciate. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you, Beth.
There's more at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There is context and background that I think is helpful to know about each of the topics I just addressed with Mayor Steinberg and the president of Electrify America. So, Cap Radio's senior editor of news and features, Nick Miller, is now in the studio. We're going to talk through some of that history. Hi, Nick. ZEV is something for us to know. If you aren't comfortable or are aware of it yet, it's the future in Sacramento, at least in light of that conversation. What is ZEV?
It's happening. They're coming.
Yeah, right.
Zero emission vehicles. And so it's really interesting because there was a new strategy that the city passed this past December of last year, and it's ambitious. They want to grow the number of zero emission vehicles in the region from only 2% of the vehicle fleet now, and in 2025, that number could be anywhere between 17,000 to 74,000.
Wow.
They want to take the number of charging stations, which is now at around 430. That's public and private charging stations. They want to grow it to 3,800 in 8 years. Mm. And the reason they're doing this is because this is happening on a statewide level. Governor Jerry Brown wants to have 1.5 million ZEVs on the road in the next 8 years. So this is a huge undertaking for the city and the state.
So we might say electric cars, that's a limiting phrase now. If you really want to talk in this conversation, ZEV is the way to go.
That's correct. This is about emissions. This is about having a carbon neutral vehicle or a vehicle that's not emitting CO2 out into the atmosphere.
We could spend a lot more time on that. We'll have an opportunity to do that over the weeks and months as this rolls out. I want to shift to the status of the investigation into the Stephon Clark case. You just heard the mayor say, as for 90 days as a target, I don't know. He said the goal is really thoroughness.
It took 7 months. Nearly 7 months for the police department to complete its investigation. And that's, according to my sources, almost threefold. They do an internal review to see if there were department policies that were violated by the two officers who fatally shot Clark this past March. They do an investigation to see if there was laws broken. And then they also do like a review that's sort of, how can we improve our policy, our pursuit policy, our use of force policies? So that took 7 months. The DA put out a statement yesterday. It could take 90 days, but it could take more. She's been telling the community the goal is to have it in 2 to 3 months. But like you said, they want to be thorough. Two, the attorney general is also involved, the State Department of Justice, and they're doing a parallel review. So I anticipate it could be longer.
You had a conversation with one of our former police chiefs.
I did. I spoke recently with Rick Brazil, who's currently the Sacramento County Inspector General. He may not be that for long. That's a side story. But he was also the former police chief of Sacramento.
I wouldn't put a timeline on the DA's office, only because as they look through it, they're looking again for all the details I don't know what evidence they have, what search warrants they've served on different items. So they want to be very, very thorough. They know it's a high-profile investigation, and they want to make sure that they have looked at every possible piece of evidence and every possible witness statement. So it's going to take a while for them to complete it. I don't know how long, but I'm convinced they're going to do a very, very thorough investigation.
The Clark family, meanwhile, has continued to stay public. The story will continue to evolve even during what will be a waiting time now, at least for a couple months. You're listening to Cap Radio senior editor Nick Miller. We're expanding on a number of stories in the news today, so let's wrap this conversation up with the Interfaith Memorial Service that was held last night. This is, of course, for the victims of the Pittsburgh synagogue. And again, there's a little bit of history here to reference and an important conversation that you had that speaks to that history.
I did. There was a vigil last night at Congregation B'nai Israel in Land Park. And the rabbi, her name is Mona Alfie, and she was actually just began as rabbi in June of 1999 when her synagogue and two others in Sacramento were firebombed by white nationalists. And she took the time yesterday to reflect on that, to discuss the healing process that the community went through in 1999, and not just at her synagogue, but in the faith community and in the region at large.
I think she addressed some of what people are walking carefully around, and yet you heard the mayor make comments in this direction of the relationship between the political climate and the documented rise in hate crimes, and then an attack such as the one that happened in Pittsburgh. So here's part of your conversation with Rabbi Mona Alfie.
Well, personally, I think there's absolutely a correlation. There was a time in our country where people of different political beliefs and different political parties could be married to each other, could be friends with each other, or neighbors with each other, where we knew how to talk with each other as opposed to at each other or around each other. And I think that's something that's really lacking in our society today, a desire to meaningfully engage with people with different beliefs and different backgrounds. I think we're somehow losing that ability to look for what we share rather than focusing on the things that make us different.
It really struck me we knew how to talk to each other. We used to pursue having conversations with people that we didn't have common ground with. Republicans and Democrats would get married, fall in love, and live together. Mm-hmm. That seems like such a radical concept in year 2018. Mm-hmm. The other thing that struck me from our conversation is she teaches the 10th grade at the synagogue. She works with 10th graders, and she discussed the rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes and hate speech in recent years.
One of the things that I do in our synagogue is I teach our 10th graders. I spend a year studying with them. And for the last decade, every single one of my students, and my students are from all over, our families live all over the county, every single one of my students in the last 10 years has reported to me stories of anti-Semitic behavior or words that have been said, that have been directed towards them while at school. And that was a shock. That is definitely a shift from the decade before.
And what prompted me asking her this question is I was watching Meet the Press on Sunday, and they had the head of the Anti-Defamation League, who said in 2017 there was a more than 50% rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes or hate speech or incidents. And that was the sharpest rise that they've ever documented. Mm. In the history of their organization. And she was able to say, yeah, this is something we've been seeing. This is a huge issue. And it was an emotional discussion, of course. And she's, you know, I think there's real concern in the communities that the tenor of the conversation nationally when it comes to these incidents is not well. And so we discussed that. She discussed that pretty candidly.
She also talked to you about what could come next. So here's some of her thoughts on that question.
I really hope that there can be some good that comes out of this horrific act. You know, but how many shootings have we had? how many horrific acts have we had in this country. Last week alone, you know, there was a murder of two African-Americans while shopping in a Kroger's by a white supremacist. It didn't even make the top of the news because there were so many other horrific things going on at the same time. I'm hoping this shakes us up.
She is echoing some of what the rabbi in Squirrel Hill, in the neighborhood in Pittsburgh, is saying, is that just something has to happen, although that's an echo of the bigger cry that's been ringing through the country this year, last year, the last couple years.
It is. It's the same sentiment and thoughts that we had after the shooting in Florida at the high school.
Sandy Hook.
After Sandy Hook.
How far back do we need to go? I think it's important that Sacramento's civic leaders have been speaking out. That's one thing. The amount of gathering, the amount of citizenry coming together is really another remarkable part of the story.
It is. And the media is sort of leading that conversation where the healing process is happening on your show. It's happening in the pages of the newspaper. It's there for the community. And one thing Rabbi Mona Alfi told me is, like, it's incumbent upon us as members of this community to sort of engage in that process, to come out of our shell, to find out, hey, who are our neighbors? You know, some people don't know who they're living next door anymore. And we've really sort of drifted, you know, closer to our screens, closer to our sort of insular silo world of social media, and we're forgetting what sometimes this actual social world is about. And it's a great conversation, and it's on capradio.org right now.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks.
That is Cap Radio senior editor Nick Miller. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio, I'm Beth Ruriak. In January of 1976, George Moscone took office as the mayor of San Francisco, the people's mayor, he was called. His time in office was short. On November 27, 1978, he and Supervisor Harvey Milk were shot and killed in City Hall by a former supervisor, Dan White. Now, the life and legacy of the former mayor, Mayor Moscone, have been traced in a new documentary produced and released by University of the Pacific. It will air on PBS stations over the next number of weeks. Here's some of George Moscone's victory speech after winning the election. This is a clip from the documentary. It begins with narration by Peter Coyote.
Moscone knew that the African-American vote had played a key role in getting him elected.
I would be less than candid with you if I didn't say that I would not be mayor of this city but for the extraordinary, underlined, extraordinary efforts of the Baptist Ministers Union in this great city, which provided me not only with more votes than all of my competitors, but the constant spirit to win in a very difficult contest. And I shan't ever forget that.
In the studio to talk about this project, which is titled Moscone, A Legacy of Change, is Teresa Bergman, professor and chair of the Department of Communication and director of graduate studies at UOP. Professor Bergman, glad
Hi.
To have you here.
Thank you.
Congratulations, by the way, on a really remarkable film.
Oh, thank you very much. It was an honor to be able to work on it.
Mia Watts is here, too. She's an undergrad at UOP and was a pre-production researcher on this project. Hi, Mia.
Hi, good morning.
Could I start by asking you how much you did or didn't know about George Moscone before this project?
So my professor asked if I wanted to be a part of the project, and she didn't tell me who it was about yet. But later on, I found out it was George Moscone, and I said, who? You know, because people mention Harvey Milk all the time, but George Moscone kind of gets swept under the rug. And so I had no idea who he was when I started the project.
And how much was that part of the point here, Professor?
Well, it was a big part of the point initially, was to address that miss in the historical record. And it was an absolute pleasure to work with students who really did not know about George Moscone and watch them learn and see and really understand his legacy.
So before he was mayor, He was a California state senator. He was a champion of many different bills, school lunch programs, LGBT rights. He had been a supervisor. But let's go back to UOP. He has quite a history on campus.
Well, he came on a basketball scholarship, and he was quite popular. We were able to interview a couple of alumni who went to school with him, Ron Leinecke and Janet Delavan, and their stories when they spoke during their interviews, their eyes would sparkle. They knew he was a great guy as a fellow classmate and a great organizer, and they were not the least bit surprised that he went on to be elected.
Mia, we're talking about an era before your time. We're going back to the 70s. What struck you about who he was and what he was saying in his time?
Well, I was responsible for looking through his Senate bills. And so I was responsible for looking through what he either introduced on the Senate floor or he either supported. And it was kind of inspiring, but kind of frustrating at the same time that he was fighting for the same things we're kind of fighting for now, like LGBT rights and rights for diverse peoples and everything like that. And so I think it was inspiring to see what he was interested in. I got to know him in that way, which is pretty cool.
Let's listen to another clip. You're going to hear first the voice of Susan Stryker. She's the author of Gay by the Bay, on a book about George Moscone's accomplishments and also how they've been given short shrift. The second voice you'll hear is Jonathan Moscone talking about his father.
I think George Moscone sometimes gets short shrift for his accomplishments, particularly in the LGBT community. Partly, I think, that's because of his proximity to Harvey Milk, who, you know, really has achieved a kind of iconic status as a martyr to gay rights. And in some ways, that overshadows what Moscone accomplished.
My dad was the first one to open the door. He pushed the door open, and he kept them open, and they never closed. And I think that the flow into and out of the halls of power changed so dramatically because of my dad.
The project is Moscone, A Legacy of Change. I want to talk about the schedule coming up, because there are a lot of different opportunities for people to see this film. But let's start with some of what's happening in the broadcast. There have been screenings on campuses over the last week, but it will debut on KVIE.
Right. It'll be on KVIE, and it's also going to be on KQED, as well as distributed across the country on PBS stations during the month of November to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the assassinations.
How pivotal was George Moscone in the change that has continued over the decades since his assassination? How pivotal was he and his vision in the change that happened?
Oh, he was very much in the front line from the beginning. He saw the importance of coalition politics in San Francisco. He was there when district elections passed and was able to put together a coalition of people who generally weren't at the table in political discussions beforehand. And he recognized, and more than recognized, believed in the importance of having people of color, GLTBQA, women, everyone at the table, part of the discussion, at all the tables, and involved in all the discussions, a legacy that we're, as Mia said, still working on today.
Well, you too had done a project previously on Harvey Milk. And why is it, as Mia said, that people have become more familiar with Harvey Milk even than George Moscone, though many places and buildings in San Francisco are named for him?
I was really lucky to work as an intern when I was getting my master's at San Francisco State on the documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, that went on to win an Academy Award. So that film really established and spread the word of what happened to Harvey Milk. That probably led to more notice, more understanding of his role and his iconic role in front of the gay movement at the time. Just George Moscone was part of that, and he was there, and he was his partner. Moscone supported Harvey Milk. So this is a time to recognize how important both were.
It It's full of so much historical detail, old photos and video, and I think it brings to life George Moscone as a person. I have a real sense of how he was on campus, how he organized, and how people really adored him. Mia, did you experience that in many dimensions of who he was at the State Senate, too?
Right, I did. Like I mentioned, I did the Senate bills, and so he listened, you know, and he cared. It wasn't kind of like bills that you just introduced to get across. There were actually issues that people cared about at the time. And my favorite one that I came across was about like mattress safety regulations. So there's even little things like that that he cared enough to want to, you know, put forth. And he cared about people. And that was important.
So again, this film will be broadcast November 5th on KVIE. It will be on KQED. It's also going to air on KRCB in Santa Rosa, Rohnert Park. And there are complimentary pieces, artifacts, information also on campus if people are interested.
Right. On UOP website, on the library website, we have films that students in my documentary production, film production class made. So you can see their take and their approach to documenting George Moscone's contribution as well. And one of the things that I just have to add, having worked on both films on Moscone as well as Milk, is how important it is to recognize their contribution during such violent political times. They were violent then and they're violent now, and we need to recognize how important it is to stay involved.
It is interesting, isn't it, that we're talking about this film in a show that has the content and subjects that we've been talking about today. Professor Bergman, thank you so very much. I appreciate the work you've done. I want to encourage teachers to take a look at this film because I think it's a wonderful teaching tool for students of many, many ages. Yeah, thank you. Mia Watts, thank you too for your work and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And again, there's more on links at capradio.org/insight. The project is Moscone, A Legacy of Change. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. So we're going to finish the hour with the Sacramento premiere of a powerful play that speaks to another hugely significant chapter in human history on this earth. The play is John O'Keefe's Times Like These. It explores the meaning of resistance through one woman's fight to use her voice in Hitler's Germany. The production is being staged by Cal Stage, California Stage, and in the studio with me are cast members Lois Mastin Ewing. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. And Gary Allen Wright. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you both here.
Thank you.
This is loosely based on a true story, so would each of you explain who your characters are? And why don't you begin, Lois, because Meta Wolf is the centerpiece of all of this.
Yeah, Meta Wolf was an actor in Berlin in the 30s, and she was just an actor. Many times throughout the play, she's talking about, I'm just an actor, that's all I am. But it comes out that her birth heritage was Jewish, so she was discovered to be a Jew. And in Berlin at that time, they just kind of were clearing out all the Jewish people out of the theater, and it comes out that she's Jewish. Nobody knew she was Jewish. Her husband, Oscar, didn't know she was Jewish, and her career is annihilated. And she goes into hiding, and Oscar doesn't have to. So.
Yeah, Gary, step in at this point and talk about
Oscar
Weiss.
Her husband Oscar is also an actor, but unlike Meta, who's a beloved theater diva, and she's famous and she's respected, and everyone acknowledges she's a big star, Oscar is just a bit player, and he's happy to be that. He's not particularly ambitious. He's happy to bask in the reflected glow of Meta's stardom. And so when it comes out that she's Jewish and the Nazi noose starts to tighten around their lives, Oscar, who's blessed with the proper Aryan heritage, his career starts to take off in ways that he never imagined it could. He becomes a darling of Goebbels and Goering, and starts getting cast in leading roles, which is brand new for him.
This play opened a few weeks ago. Do you think audiences are receiving and hearing it differently since this weekend?
Well, Saturday was a really interesting show because that's when the shooting was. And you know, Gary and I had our own things to do in terms of acting and all that. But there was this different, I really remember thinking there was a different energy. There was a different attention. I mean, it's a show that, you know, you really calls for you to pay attention. But Saturday, there was something kind of special and sad.
You know what, Lois? I feel it in having this conversation with you. I could have a conversation about this play at a different time. I don't think it would be moving me the way this is right now.
Indeed. Well, this play, it's a cautionary tale among being a love story and this beautiful story anyway. But it talks about, you know, leadership in a country, kind of taking over and having this kind of mass kind of la-la land happen to the people. And so when Saturday happened and everybody showed up and was just kind of in shock, and then seeing this story, I mean, theater, we're storytellers first, mm-hmm. and seeing this story about this happens in history, and when are we going to stop having this happen?
It's really interesting how the relevance of this play keeps snowballing because, you know, it was written about 16 years ago as a response to the Bush administration's response to 9/11 and the run-up to war in Iraq and the Patriot Act and all that stuff. So it was resonant in ways back then that I think were not even imagined. It keeps gaining in resonance, you know. I mean, it's resonant in ways now that it wasn't then, and it's resonant in ways this week that it wasn't when we opened 2 weeks
ago. Right.
So that's Gary Allen Wright. He plays Oscar, and Lois Mastin Ewing plays Meta. Richard Winters is the director. This is the Sacramento premiere of John O'Keefe's play, Times Like These. It continues through November 18th. The shows are Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2, and the staging is by California Stage Theater. You're going to do a reading, aren't you, from the play?
We'd like to, if you'd like us to.
Please do.
Great. Do you want to lead up to this?
Yeah, go ahead and set it up. So this takes place in the first act, and the play is, it's sort of a two lobsters in a pot story. Mm-hmm. You know, the water's fine at the beginning of the play, and then it starts to get uncomfortable pretty quickly, and then the playwright spends the next 90 minutes turning up the heat, and this is early in the play when Meta has started to figure out, sort of has started to see what the future might hold, and they're both sort of being shaken out of their complacency and forced to deal with things. Okay, so here's the reading.
I never wanted to think about politics. I took it for granted that civilized people would act in good taste. Now everything I know has been turned around. Nothing is the same. I used to think there were crazy people and sane people, but now I know that we are all crazy. How else would you explain it? That little screaming man is our leader. And I'll tell you something else. Guys like him, once they're in office, they never let go.
I know you're frightened, but this foolishness, it won't last long. It can't.
Why not?
Because this is Germany.
Oh, yes. Yes, I didn't think of that.
That is a scene from Times Like These. Again, continuing through November 18th. At the California Stage Theater. This is in the R25 Arts Complex, which, if you don't know, is 1725 25th Street in Midtown Sacramento. So before I leave you both, give me your connection for you personally, doing this play in this time with where we are at this moment, October 30th, 2018. Gary?
Well, it's a really special feeling to be involved with a project that sort of ticks all the boxes of everything that made me fall in love with theater to begin with. You know, it's great writing. It's a chance for me to stretch as an actor, and it feels so painfully relevant to right now.
Indeed. Well, for me, I mean, as an actor, you're kind of very concerned with self. And this play talks about an actor who all of a sudden discovers the world in a way that was kind of an imposition. She didn't really want to. She would have been happy to just be plod along. And I kind of relate to that sometimes. And now we all must pay attention.
Lois Mastin Ewing and Gary Allen Wright, along with Richard Winters, they are award-winning theater performers and directors. You can see them on stage. We'll post a link with more information. Thank you both for making time for
this.
Thank you so much. I think it was really important to have this in our hour today. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.